Good afternoon. This is The Main Course, Part Q on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My partner, Patrick Martins, is on the road counting turkeys. He's out in Kansas City, Missouri right now with his distributor, but he'll be back with us next week. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored by Roberta's today. I'm pleased and flattered. Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn at 261 Yay! Moore Street. Come on down. They've got really good eats here. And today my guests are Andy Smith, a professor at the New School and a food historian, the author of some 19 books. Is that right?
17 published.
17. Okay, published.
Two more.
And the most recently being Eating History, 30.
30 turning points in the making of American cuisine.
There you go. And my other guest today is Curtis B. Wayne, another host on Heritage Radio Network with his own program.
Pleased to be here in the afternoon because Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com is on Wednesday nights. I'm so disappointed. There's no fire pit action here.
I know, right?
You need the dancing natives in the fire pit, really, for that ambiance.
It does create a very special tone to the home, as it were.
But I'm happy to be here, Katie, since,
well, thank you for joining
I was
us
a
today.
Line cook for 2 years, and I know how to fry eggs. So yeah. I'm right in with the food people.
That's it.
Right. So, Andy, the reason, aside from the pleasure of seeing you again at Heritage Radio Network, I thought it would be fun for listeners to hear a little bit about why we eat what we eat at this particular time of year. And so let's go way. Let's get in the way back machine.
Yeah, this time
Thanksgiving.
Of year.
Yep. This is the Thanksgiving time of year.
Thanksgiving's good. I like Thanksgiving.
I know. I figured you would. And let's get into the way back machine and go to about, let's say like maybe the late 18th century, sort of immediately post-revolution and when things were kind of settling down and America was really starting to be America.
Well, let me give you 2 seconds of history to get there first.
Okay, let's do it.
And that is that the pilgrims had nothing to do with Thanksgiving dinner. So all these myths that we have floating around
Thank
are all
you.
Nice. They celebrated Thanksgiving, but it was a day you spent in church. And you didn't do frivolous activities like cook meals and food and things like that. So
no.
The Thanksgiving dinner really does come in exactly when you said about 1780.
So Squanto or Massasoit or that sachem didn't bring food to the starving people in Massachusetts Bay Colony?
Well, there is one description of an event that occurs in the fall of 1621 when the pilgrims actually had their first harvest, and their harvest was plentiful. They had a lot of food. They had just signed a treaty with Massasoit, and Massasoit decides he's going to come with 80 of his braves, and they're going
to partake of that, of that
not
harvest.
Not a feast. They're going to come
celebrate
and visit
the treaty.
They're going to celebrate the treaty, right?
Okay.
And so the pilgrims, who are at that point have their crops are in.
They've got some grain.
They're firing off their guns, trying to take target practice and doing all the normal things. But there's only about 40 or 50 of them. So these Indians come unannounced, and Indians have a real problem. They want food. So they go out and get it. So they go out and hunt deer, and they bring in deer, and they hunt fowl, which would have been common at that time. And there is that event that happens, but it's not a Thanksgiving.
But didn't they also have huge lobsters that would wash ashore but that was not eating food. That was something you just threw in as fertilizer in the crops.
Yeah, well, lobster was not a common food. It wasn't certainly an upper class food. It was a starvation food. You only ate that when you had nothing else. And when you have lobster with claws from that were about 6 feet from arm to arm, you can imagine that they really aren't the tastiest of seafood.
Right.
Pretty rubbery.
So the lobster,
if they had it at that first feast,
no evidence.
It wouldn't have been let's have a 6-foot lobster.
No. Definitely not.
No. Okay. The only evidence is, again, it's only corn and fowl, whatever that may mean, a variety of fowl. It could be turkey.
And some venison, perhaps.
And venison. A lot of venison. They've got exactly 7 deer that they went out and brought back and cooked. So,
really?
So if you think that's a Thanksgiving, then you need venison. So venison should be.
So we shouldn't really be eating a turkey. We should be, and certainly not something with a great big.
But fowl would have been wild turkey, I'm supposing, or maybe pigeon.
Well, you have this whole incident.
Well, fowl was like pheasant, quail,
which
swans,
were numerous at the time. In I mean, there were millions of of them in
quail in Massachusetts. I think of quail as like a Texan thing.
Not at all. That's definitely a New England bird.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Passenger pigeons. There are only 5 billion passenger pigeons in America when colonial Americans came.
So. Wow.
So you had this huge plethora of fowl. It could have been anything. But the quick answer was this was written up in a letter, and the letter was sent back to England, and it was published in England in 1622.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And well, the goal was they needed more people.
They wanted more people to come to the colony.
They needed a lot of people.
So they wanted people.
So they had these nice little stories about how wonderful the Indians were and how wonderful the deer is there, and you can capture them easily.
So it's a real Governor Bradford wrote an enthusiastic bit of PR and sent it back. And
well, it was another. It was a man by the Edward Winslow who becomes governor, but later on. Mm-hmm. But there's no other description of this, and the whole letter is lost until 1841, when a New England historian picks up the letter, reprints it, and then says, in a little footnote, this is the first Thanksgiving. And this is the only footnote that I know of that has ever affected a culinary history in America or any place else.
Isn't that fascinating?
The New England historians picked this up, and then everyone claimed this was the first Thanksgiving, but there is no Thanksgiving dinners at all, no descriptions of them, and no primary source evidence for it until the 1780s. So mm-hmm. you really have 200 years of non-stories, and it's not likely that would have been an important part of New England.
What do you think were what was the political climate that drove the decision to assign a feast day to this particular day, and that people would want to celebrate that? I mean, I feel like there's some sort of political agenda there, wouldn't you say?
There is an agenda, but it's not really political. It starts off by a woman. Women do everything. They cause all sorts of problems. And one of them is the name of Sarah Josepha Hale. And
Sarah Hale, of course.
Sarah Hale was a poet and was one of, as far as I know, the first novelist to write a large novel in America.
Did she write the Peterkin Papers?
No,
Sarah
she wrote Northwood, a story of New England, and then she wrote a subsequent second volume about a story of the life in the South. So she had these two things, but here her Northwood got her huge visibility, and she became an editor of a magazine, Gottie's Magazine, which was the most,
Gottie's Ladies Book.
Yeah, which was by far the most important ladies' magazine in America prior to the Civil War.
It was the only one, as far as I know.
Well, there were several, but this one dwarfed every other.
In Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, even, they mentioned Gottie's Ladies Book as coming out, like when they would send a barrel west to the homesteaders or something, there would often be several back issues, and the people would go crazy, you know, read it over and over again and cut out the pictures. And I mean, it was a great source of information of all types. For the female population who were, you know, the frontiers women.
So Sarah Hale, in any case, writes a whole chapter on her Thanksgiving dinners, which she remembers from her childhood, about 1800, describing pretty much what we have today. So you would have all
with
the
recipes.
Well, there's no recipes in it, but she happens to publish a large number of cookbooks after that, and, mm-hmm. and the cookbooks include recipes mm-hmm. for many of those products.
So did she include turkey?
Turkey was indeed a central part, but it wasn't the only part. You would have had a lot of pot pies, for instance. It could have been turkey pot pies. It could have been chicken pot pies. It could have been beef pot pies. You would have had venison at that time. It still would have been a very common food that you would have consumed all over America until almost the late 19th century. So you would have had all those things. You would not have had potatoes. The potatoes were there, but they were not common at that point. You would not have had any sweet potatoes because they didn't grow in New England, and you didn't have any trade at that point. Relatively little trade.
So what was their starch? Just bread?
They had bread. Bread would have been very common. You would have had the fall vegetables. So the vegetables that would have been available, squash, for instance, would have been common. And obviously, you're going to make pies out of that.
Yeah.
And apples would have been common. So you would have had that. Raisins, if we have lots of grapes, and raisins would have been common. So you have lots of things that would have been available in New England in the fall would have been part of what you would have consumed. But the historical story is fascinating. She reads this footnote in this 1841 compendium of articles about the early life in New England, and she is convinced that America needs a fall holiday. And at the time, there were only two national holidays. One was
the Independence Day.
4th of July, which is celebrated in the summer. And the first one was, no one ever gets this. Anybody?
Are you saying it wasn't Christmas?
It's not Christmas. No, Christmas is still kind of religious. In New England, it wasn't celebrated for a long time after that. But it doesn't become a national holiday until 1870.
I'm guessing May Day or something.
You would think this. It's Washington's birthday. None of us remember Washington's birthday because now we celebrate all the presidents.
I think that is so wrong.
It's disgusting.
Because when I was younger, it was still two separate events, Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday.
And they were two presidents that we look back on with great pleasure.
But, yes.
But all the rest of the presidents, one has some questions on. In any case, moving along.
But in New York, there was Evacuation Day, which is a great day of feasting, celebrating the Monday in November of 1783 when the British were finally driven out of New York.
That's Boston. That was
in
New York too.
In New York, November 23rd.
And all of the loyalists were sent north to
Halifax.
Nova Scotia.
Yeah,
they became Canadians, right?
They did.
And they've never forgiven us since.
No, they haven't. But until World War I, Evacuation Day was a great feast day, and the descendants of Jack Van Arsdale.
Somebody should write a novel about that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, don't you think? It's called Accidental Yankee, and with any luck, it'll be published by maybe 2012.
Oh, that's great. let me continue the Thanksgiving story.
Let's keep going.
Before he gets on to his novel.
Yeah, absolutely, because he can go for quite a while on that. Yeah, and we invited you here to talk about Thanksgiving, much as we enjoy hearing
turkeys
about
Accidental
Yankee.
So Hale starts campaign to celebrate Thanksgiving and on the fourth Thursday of November, and she starts off by writing to governors saying all governors should declare that day as Thanksgiving, because at that point you could have had Thanksgiving in the spring, you could have had it in the summer, you could have had it in the fall, you could have celebrated a lot of different times. And so she does engages in this campaign, and she does that all the way for 17 years.
It took her 17 years to get this declared?
No, then she failed. And she fails when the Civil War starts, so she can't communicate with the South. She does very well. So I think she has most of the states in 1860. But then the Civil War begins, and she can't communicate with anyone. So she's made a good connection with a former governor of New York by the name of William Seward. And William Seward just happens to be the Secretary of War in the Lincoln administration. And so she goes to him and says, don't you think it would be a really nice idea to have a national proclamation of Thanksgiving? And they hem and haw until after the battles of Gettysburg and Vicksburg, in which the Union had great victories. And Lincoln says, that's a great idea. So Seward writes up this proclamation, Lincoln signs it, and that's the beginning of Thanksgiving as a national holiday.
Incredible. That's fabulous.
So that's why we celebrate. Sarah, we can blame her as all the things that we're going to be
doing.
Well,
it is my favorite holiday of the year, and I think for many people it is.
It is, mine too.
It's just the most.
I think it is the national holiday that everyone, irrespective of
religion or
national background, celebrates. But the conformity of the foods that we eat, it just astounds me.
Well, it depends on who you are. Those of us who
are there regional differences?
Well, there are some regional differences, but the main is ethnic differences. So if you happen to be of Italian heritage, many people of Italian heritage will have spaghetti, of course. And if you happen to be of Asian heritage, you might well have rice. And so you have a whole series of other things. And so frequently the turkey is the centerpiece, which combines all of Americans
sort of
together at a single time.
All ethnic.
And then the other side dishes are depending on who you are.
One of my favorite things about eating turkey when we were growing up was wild rice. And wild rice has become kind
of commercial rice today.
But when I was little, wild rice was really almost worth its weight in gold.
Did you grow up in Minnesota?
No, I didn't. I grew up in Rhode Island. But for some reason, my mother was totally keyed into wild rice. And it was like, we literally had it once or twice a year.
That's so interesting. Because wild rice only,
expensive.
I think, in those days came from Minnesota.
It only was grown in Minnesota. Yeah. Absolutely.
And today, 99% of it is all grown commercially in California.
And it does not taste the same.
And many of the Native Americans who live in Minnesota are not happy with
them. I can imagine. Mm-hmm. But their product is actually, heritage breed. Actually, Patrick should be selling that in Heritage Foods USA, because it is that Minnesota wild rice is very different from the commercially produced product that we're more familiar
with now. I understood that the native peoples go out in canoes and beat the rice into their into their boats.
Yeah, into some sort of a floating net kind of thing. Uh-huh. Yeah. So when did that start? When did that become part of the national?
That really was relatively recently. And again, the problem was you had a distribution system. You had to get it out of Minnesota and get it out to other places.
Yeah.
It surprises me that you would have had that
in New England.
In New England
at
that time,
because starting in the 50s.
Right. I made a point of always trying to fly into Minnesota to pick up some. And it was sold in the airport.
Yeah.
So you try to get a stopover. You know, fly Northwest or something like that, just to stop over there to pick up a little. It cost at that point $5 or $6
a
relatively small bag.
I think it was a 4 or 6 ounce package.
Yeah.
It was at least $6 or $7.
They tasted so good.
It's amazing. Yeah. And it's still really delicious.
But it's hard to cook. You have to cook it.
You have to cook it a long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
Carefully and slowly.
Yeah.
Well, that's all good.
But all good food has to be cooked carefully and slowly, unfortunately.
Gee, I don't know.
You know, everybody wants the quick fix meal.
Flash fried.
Yeah. It's just, you know, food does not really respond. Relatively few foods respond to being cooked quickly.
Chicken fried steaks, fine. Yeah,
that's
with white gravy.
Well, greens. I mean, the Chinese have definitely got it. The Asians definitely have it over on the greens with the really quick sauté. But other than that, there's really relatively few things that do not benefit from a nice long slow cook.
And low heat.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So besides wild rice, which I remember, the other products that were ubiquitous when I was growing up, and I think things have branched out a bit, but because vegetables were really relative. I mean, if you think about it, in the 50s and 60s, we didn't have the vegetable panoply that we have now. So you really were sort of limited to what was, you know, iceberg lettuce, the crummy tomatoes and the cellophane thing. And then there was, you know, squash, sweet potatoes,
right. And
green beans. I know not from where, because
green beans were usually canned. That's how you
or jarred.
Yeah, you would have taken them out of a can. Today, of course, you have green beans that are available in the fall. But historically, that was not the case.
When did that green bean casserole thing come in?
I traced it back to the 1950s.
Uh-huh.
So it was a Campbell soup.
It was a Campbell soup construct.
Construct that may well have existed prior to that time, but they were the ones that popularized, and they get the credit for it. And it's not bad. Come on. You know, you look
it's
at me strangely
hideous.
When I say but that. It's not bad.
It's a terrible thing. You take a little bit so as to not offend your grandmother.
Oh.
I
remember in the 50s when my mother first made it. It was the hit of Thanksgiving. So
Oh, yeah. All
I can do is say it was spectacular. It was so surprising to have green beans and soup at the same time. So, that was the 50s.
Well, it was green beans and gravy, basically, right? I mean, isn't that because that cream of mushroom
soup
was
really
thick.
Gravy. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very
You didn't
very
put
thick.
Water in this.
Right.
Right.
So you just kind of glopped out the cream of mushroom soup, which was solidified by some sort of modified food starch, I believe, although maybe that came later.
What always got me was the shaved almonds on top, that weird crunch thing.
Or no, those are like crisped onions, aren't they? I thought it was like crispy little onions.
I suppose
thing.
Every family has its own
special,
version of this hideous dish.
It's wonderful.
We did green beans with almonds, but there was no cream of mushroom involved. It was just like a lot of butter. But there were probably about, I'm thinking about 4 or 5 dishes that almost all Americans ate at a certain period. And probably many still do. One of them was that. And the other one was sweet potato puree with marshmallows on top.
I looked that up because when you emailed me, you mentioned it. It's a 1920s recipe.
No kidding.
I was surprised.
I didn't know marshmallows existed in the 20s.
Oh, no. Marshmallow goes back centuries. I mean, it was a part of traditional cooking. But the commercial version of what we think of as marshmallows tonight is really an early 19th century invention. And like Jell-O, which the Jell-O company put out millions of different types of recipes on how you could use Jell-O.
Yeah.
The marshmallow companies started putting out millions of different recipes on how you could use marshmallows.
Who made marshmallows? First.
Oh, I don't know the company. I'm sorry. I didn't find it. I didn't know.
Isn't it just sponge sugar in a different sort of form?
It's egg whites.
It's
and sugar.
Yeah.
And
so it's a soft meringue.
I don't know how they created the elasticity.
That's the commercial one, right?
Yeah. I mean, basically a meringue product, but what is it that makes it? Because they didn't have corn syrup then.
1900, sure.
They had corn syrup in 1900?
Absolutely.
I'm surprised by that. So, I did not realize.
So the quick answer is, this is a commercial product that's encouraged for Americans to consume it in 1,000 different ways. And this is one of the ways that
this
ends
is
up,
one of the
that,
ways.
It's a way that we survive. Most of the other recipes are long gone.
Yeah.
But this one makes it because it's a holiday. It's a part of holiday tradition.
Well, and it was something that would really appeal to children.
And children, right.
Yes. So, of course, you know, I adored it. I thought it was absolutely spectacular. It was my first experience with toasting marshmallows that was not like, you know, one of the flaming hot blob on the stick, you know. The campfire experience. Burn the bejesus out of your mouth. Anyway, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute with Andy Smith and Curtis Wayne.
I got a mule and a name is Sam. 15 miles on the Erica now. She's a good old worker and a good old pal. 15 miles on the Erica now. We hauled some barges in our day, filled with lumber, coal, and hay. We know every inch of the way from underneath to Buffalo.
And we've got the boss singing 15 miles on the Erie Canal, an old, old, all-American song.
Not so old. Actually, a 20th century song.
It's a late version, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is the main course, Part Q, on Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored today by Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, 261 Moore Street. Come on down, guys. They're open, and it's a happening place. Man, the joint is absolutely packed, and the garden is open. It's really nice outside. So if you want to have a little plein air dining experience, do come to Roberta's. I have in the studio with me Andy Smith, a food historian and a professor at the New School and author of...
So many books.
So many books. 17 and counting. But most recently, what came out in September was
Eating History,
30 Turning Points.
In the Making of American Cuisine.
Yeah, which was great fun. A really lovely book. And our
Who's
other
that published by?
Well, it just happened to be published by Columbia University Press.
That's really great.
Yeah,
so it's a scholarly work.
Yeah, it does have footnotes, but I've tried to make it popular in the front section.
That's yeah, no, good. It's a lot of fun. That was really fun to read. I breezed through that book in no time. It was like, you know, you just couldn't put it down. It was one fabulous little food factoid after another. I mean, what's not to love about that? We're interested in the business.
Sounded it's good like, to me.
Yeah, it was really, and you're working on a drinking history.
I am.
And that'll come out when?
It's a tough job. Somebody's got to do it. It's
right.
The research that goes into it. And
I know, Andy.
It'll come out when I've finished writing it and then about a year after that. It's, the research is taking a lot longer than anticipated.
It's rough. You have a lot of work cut out for you. There's plenty of things to sample. First of all, there's all those punches that Americans were so famous for and all the wonderful cocktails that we've produced in this country.
And you've got to try them multiple times in order
you
to
do.
Make sure that you have regional styles.
Well, you want the definitive,
and
exactly.
Then you've got to have historical recipes, and then you've got to have modern recipes. You've got to compare the two. It's very difficult.
Oh, my God. I was reading an Esquire magazine, actually, and this month's issue of Esquire, by the way, features our very own Patrick Martins as one of the best and the brightest for Heritage Foods USA. But anyway, I was leafing through the magazine this morning drinking tea, and they had a little section on a couple of different punches. Punch is always sort of a mixed bag for me. Sometimes it's really great. Sometimes it's really disgusting. But this one, they had a recipe where they took a cone of sort of some particular type of sugar that was popular in Germany, but can be, was it, I mean, I think you could probably even use Vietnamese sugar or something like that. A brown sugar, an unrefined sugar, they put it on a poker, and they put that over a bowl that had fruits and various other, and then they poured hot rye whiskey over the sugar into the punch, which would melt some of the sugar down, and you kept on doing that as you sipped.
See, there's now, always something new, and you always, and you have to search out every single punch in order to feel as though you know what you're talking about.
Well, I thought, now that's a drink where you could really do some damage.
That sounds like a lot of work, not though, only just for lethal, a little bit of whiskey and some sugar.
Want to go the whiskey straight.
It started with 2 quarts of some sort of very peaty whiskey, and they gave sort of a low-cost version and then said you could use Lafroy if you wanted to. And I thought, a $75 bottle of whiskey, I don't think so. But 2 quarts of the smoky whiskey, and then you poured 2 quarts of rye over the cone of hot rye. Crazy. Anyway, let's go back to the pilgrims and Thanksgiving. Yeah,
we didn't really get around to, you know, why the turkey. And when I was growing up, my maternal grandfather every year photographed the table. And every year, the turkey had to be bigger. It didn't matter if there were more people. It had to be a bigger and bigger and bigger turkey.
Right.
I think for him, that was symbolic of social, life is good.
Social status.
It was prosperity.
Yeah,
doing better.
Yeah, yeah.
More money, bigger turkey.
Yeah, I think for him, it would have been anathema if there were a couple of skinny little ducks. It might have tasted better than this huge, big.
But in a way, it sort of correlates to cars. Right?
Sure.
Because it goes from, you know, like the more prosperous you are, the bigger the car you have. There was a time when that was how you measured somebody's wealth.
Certainly social status is a factor in it.
Absolutely.
But the quick answer, from the earliest records that we have of Thanksgiving dinners in the late 18th century, you have a turkey as part of it.
Yes.
It doesn't necessarily, isn't necessarily the only product. There could be a number of different major dishes. But by the late 19th century, the turkey is the centerpiece for virtually every description of a meal.
But why not ham?
It's low cost.
And why not ham? We've had pigs everywhere.
The goal of Thanksgiving is to bring your family together, and it's often your extended family, and it's often your friends. And so you need something that can feed a lot of people. And so,
yeah, but Andy, they weren't making turkeys with the huge, big breast that they do now. I mean, my cousin shot a couple of wild turkeys on his farm in Rhode Island a couple of years ago, and we had those. And they're really little. They're only, I mean, fully dressed, they're 8 pounds.
That's the turkeys that have survived. The wild turkeys.
This was a wild turkey.
Wild turkeys could weigh up to 50 or 60 pounds. And they don't, you're looking at me strangely.
All I am, because, I mean, I've seen lots and lots of them.
Today are the ones that are smaller.
Smaller and faster.
Oh, I see, because they're quicker. Yeah.
Right. They make it out of the, they can run faster.
Well, they can still fly.
And the big turkeys couldn't fly at all, right. So they were the first ones that were obviously hit and consumed. But historically, the wild turkeys were larger than the domesticated turkeys.
Uh-huh.
And it's only in the 20th century, when you have the broad-breasted white that comes on, that really takes over the market. So that today, 99.9% of the turkeys that Americans consume are strains of broad-breasted white.
Right.
But historically, you would have had, they would have been much smaller. They would have been 13 to maybe 20 pounds. They would not have, they would have been domesticated turkeys, but not the broad-breasted white.
Right, right.
So in 1841 through the Civil War, were we talking domesticated turkey or wild turkey that somebody
the wild turkeys called from the woods? The best estimate is there's something like 10 to 15 million wild turkeys in America when colonial times come, but they're very naturally a very inquisitive bird, and you just walked out your door and you shot a turkey. You had to hunt them.
I mean, in Rhode Island, you can do that now. They come right up to the house if there's anything around for them to eat.
Well, it's not just eat. They're curious. They're very curious about anything
but
different
dumb
and new.
As stumps.
And they'll stay about 20 feet away from you, and if you've got a gun, you can pick them up. Now, I understand farmers on Long Island today are having difficulty finding them, but historically, they were actually very easy to kill.
Well, if you have a wooded area anywhere near you, they do like to, they like both the woods and the fields. They nest in the woods.
I have to say, I have seen really enormous wild turkeys on Staten Island. If you take the ferry across and you get on the Staten Island Rapid Transit train and you go out headed for Staten Island University Hospital. Around the hospital, there are huge wild turkeys wandering around in people's suburban backyards. And they're mean. And people are afraid of them.
No.
And they stand a good yard high.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're very tall.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, starkly, that's what the wild turkey would have been
okay,
like.
Okay, well, so we still have
some. You've got some. They've
in
been
Staten Island.
Allowed. Staten Island has the surviving group. But so the quick answer is you would have had breeds of turkeys, which began to develop about the American Civil War. So the Bourbon Red, which is now common, that Patrick Martin's is selling, is wonderful.
Right.
And you had the Narragansett breed, and there was a whole series of other breeds that would have been common.
Mm-hmm.
But the largest turkey would have been the broad-breasted bronze, and that starts off with it's the beginning of the broad-breasted white. It's the largest one, and it is cheap. It's cheaper than pork. It's cheaper than beef, and it's cheaper than chicken by
a pound basis. So that's the reason.
So that's the main reason. Yeah. But also, turkey is symbolic of America. It's something unique. Pig isn't unique, and cows aren't unique. And
Franklin
aren't
wanted to make the turkey the official American bird.
Yeah, that's
turkey
nice.
Turkey does not grow in Europe.
That's a nice story.
It was not an indigenous species to Europe.
That's not a true story?
No.
It's just an urban legend.
Oh, poor Curtis.
I know. I really hate about
Andy,
Thanksgiving is that every time people mention these myths,
bubble.
I know. I love Thanksgiving. I love the myth.
It's okay.
They're as interesting as the reality, though.
What Franklin did was he actually went with Thomas Jefferson, and they had a proposal for a symbol for the United States. And their symbol happened to be Moses crossing the Red Sea. That was the symbol that they thought America should have. We're moving out of Egypt, and we're moving into the promised land.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Congress didn't go along with them. So
damn Puritans.
So when the Congress selected the bald eagle, Franklin wrote a letter to his daughter saying, I would rather that they picked the turkey, which is our true American bird. And then that letter was published within days of the time that he wrote it.
He was famous for doing stuff like that.
I'm sure he sent a copy to all the
to his own
editors.
Newspaper.
His own newspaper, yeah.
So, but in any case, that's where that story began. Matter of fact,
he may never have written the letter to his daughter. He may have just
published it
in a Saturday Evening Post.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's part of the Thanksgiving and the turkey story. But the turkey is a symbol of America. And just for your information, it really is an Asian bird. I know this confuses everybody.
I didn't know that.
It walked right across from Asia into North America several million years ago. Well, at that point, the water levels were much lower, and you had actually hundreds of miles of connection. But the turkey is very closely associated with the Asian pheasant. You can mate the two, and you can have live progeny. And it's very closely associated with the peacock and with the guinea hen of Africa. So you have this really bizarre...
Is that where we got guinea hens?
Well, guinea hens come from Africa. That's right. They came into the United States.
And were they brought by the slave trade?
They were part of European cuisine prior to that time. So they could have come through the slave trade, or they could have come through Europe.
Uh-huh.
Likewise with watermelon, for instance, which is an African...
crop, but it
had been proliferated throughout Europe prior to the discovery of America. So most likely it was introduced by Europeans, not by the slave trade.
Right.
So we had that connection. But getting back to the famous turkey, the turkey literally was here for several million years, and it was isolated. And what we think of as the turkey, the species are archaeologically going back about 50,000 years.
Wow!
So and it was domesticated relatively recently, and domesticated turkeys were always smaller than the wild turkeys. And this was why farmers tried to breed
the bigger
wild
ones.
Turkeys and domesticated turkeys in order to get bigger turkeys and get bigger flesh on them so they can make more money.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, that's why we do it with cattle now.
Well, and everything else. Yes.
Yeah, everything else. I mean, all crops. I mean, everything. You want more yield per square inch of soil, essentially. I mean, that's what agriculture has been trying to do for the last 50, 60 years, at least, is to maximize the quantity of product that can be grown in one square foot of space. So same, poultry, cattle, all the crops. I mean, it's all kind of the same story in American agriculture. It's kind of,
So
all
Andy,
about getting a
does anybody, regionally serve fish at Thanksgiving?
That's un-American.
That would be very un-American. But what about the pies?
Now, excuse me. There are two exceptions.
Because I was looking forward to my Thanksgiving sushi.
What about the oyster stuffing? The fish.
I want to come back. There are two major exceptions to that. The first are vegetarians.
Yeah.
And they tend not to eat turkey on Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Of course.
That's a basic principle.
It would be so wrong.
And they have large demonstrations, etc. And the others are groups of American Indians who think that Thanksgiving should be celebrated as a day of mourning. So consequently, they tend not to celebrate it and tend not to eat turkeys either. So that's the one day they might not do that. So there are groups.
People do eat fish because they do. I grew up eating oyster stuffing in my turkey.
Oyster stuffing it's actually a Renaissance. It was originally, you would have stuffed that into a peacock or into a duck
or into
a swan or into even a chicken. And today, most people don't do it because the price of oysters are too high.
Yeah.
But at that point, oysters were extremely common. New York, as you may well know, the New York Harbor was the largest single oyster bed in the world in colonial and early American times, and it's only and recently they're coming back now. So
they are. I mean, we had people on from River Project in August who are oyster farming in the Hudson right now and in New York Harbor. So there's a lot of conservation movements that are bringing back oyster beds, not only here but also up in my own hometown in Matunuck, Rhode Island. We met a guy this summer named Perry Rosso who has what's called the Matunuck Oyster Bar, and he opened the restaurant because he's been farming oysters now for the last 7 or 8 years, and he's got a consortium of other oyster farmers up and down the Rhode Island coastline who he does business with and supports by selling it through his restaurant. So it's, I mean, all along the New England coastline, oysters, which had been decimated by pollution and overfishing, are now being farmed as a really great way of cleaning up the water. And
You have some really great environmental stories. The wild turkey is one. In 1900, the best estimate was there were only 30,000 wild turkeys in America, and they were they were geared for extinction. In large part, farmers didn't want wild turkeys because they ate the crops and they ate everything else.
Sure.
And so they'd stick their dogs on them. They weren't hunters particularly. And so the wild turkeys only survived in very few places in America. So you have that of a problem. And it's the first animal that I know of that was reintroduced into the wild and has a tremendous success story. And today, the best estimate is there are more wild turkeys in America today than there were when Europeans first arrived.
That's incredible. Except I'm not surprised, having grown up in New England, where we never saw wild turkey until about 10 years ago. And now they're just flitting across your lawn at dusk.
They've become a nuisance in many places.
No, they're not like Canadian geese. They don't leave as much of a mess around.
Yes, but then there's white-tailed deer.
And the white-tailed deer, they don't have any of the...
White-tailed deer are their own special little problem, but that's because they carry those friendly little things.
And they love to cavort in front of moving automobiles.
We have a small farm in New Jersey, and we have a fence that's probably 6 feet high.
They can get over that, no problem.
They jump it.
Absolutely.
You know, my wife says, well, we're just feeding the deer. They need to be fed, too.
Well, you know... Only until you get Lyme disease or babesiosis or Ehrlichia.
We've all had that. done that.
Yeah, right? Haven't we all? Yeah. Anybody who has spent any time in the woods in the last 15 years has had Lyme disease, no question about it.
Probably even before that, we just didn't know it. Yeah.
I don't know. I grew up in the woods.
One of my questions, apropos of the Erie Canal.
Yeah, Erie Canal.
Which I know you're an expert on that.
I just happened to have written a chapter on it, yes. I did.
Yeah. How did Americans' eating habits change because of transportation? The Erie Canal was the first superhighway of commerce.
I was hoping you'd raise that.
That's why I'm here. Thank you. I read your book, too.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Well, prior to the Erie Canal's construction, most food was consumed and raised locally.
Right.
So you would have raised your own wheat, you would have raised your own corn, and what you didn't raise, you would have bartered with other farmers and exchanged the products back and forth. The exceptions to that are obviously, depending on where you are, salt and spices and
but it was a subsistence sort of economy.
My estimate was 90% of what you would have consumed would have been raised locally. After the Erie Canal, the obvious answer is it's whatever is least expensive, and Americans loved it. So you could produce wheat first in western New York and then later in the Midwest, and you could import it into the East Coast, where at that point all the grain had, prior to that time, the grain had been grown. And you could do it cheaper, even when you counted transportation costs, than you could grow it yourself. So Americans were delighted to end the local consumption or the local restrictions on the food.
So, that's when we started the Grain Belt.
Yeah, Grain Belt's one example of it, but then later on the beef will follow the grain,
and
then you have a thousand other things to follow from that. But if you want to point to any one thing that ends local food in America, and that's the construction of the Erie Canal and other canals.
So where do sweet potatoes come from?
I was hoping you'd ask that question too. I don't have a chapter on that, but I like sweet potatoes. And
I love sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes really start off in Central South America, along with cassava.
Uh-huh.
And along with a whole number of other peanuts, for instance, another product, they in prehistoric times, they come into the Caribbean. The Spanish run into them when they begin their explorations in the late 15th and early 16th century. They say, this is really good products. We're going to ship them into Africa. They are tropical. All of them are tropical plants. They go into Africa. They're immediately adopted
absolutely.
In Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, peanuts changed the economy.
I thought the peanut was an African thing that came here.
No, well, South then American, from, and then it went to Africa.
It's South America, and it goes to Africa, and then through the slave trade, cassava, sweet potatoes, and peanuts all come into the United States in the South. And it is people from sub-Saharan Africa who know how to grow those, and they raise them on their own small plots of land that the plantation owners gave them, and they become a part of American cuisine through the slave trade.
Wow.
It's interesting that peanuts aren't actually a bigger part, given how big a deal they, a big place they play in, say, Senegalese cuisine and other West African countries. It's surprising that it isn't a more prominent part of Southern American cuisine. I mean, peanuts.
But I had the notion that until Washington Carver, it wasn't considered that peanuts were actually for people to eat.
Oh, you know what?
Well, it's true. In America, they just fed them to livestock.
I love Curtis. Every time I come here, can you invite Curtis on?
These things that everybody believes,
and it's not true.
It's not true.
So, no.
Washington Carver did not popularize peanuts.
Well, let's take a quick break.
Without which, we couldn't have had a baseball game with peanuts and a beer.
Those are all good stories. We'll have to wait.
We're going to come back in about a minute. Talk about peanuts, Washington Carver, and just urban mythology. Thanks, guys.
A body is a cage that keeps me from dancing with the one I love, but my mind was a key. My body is a cage that keeps me from dancing with the one I love, but my mind was a key. I'm standing on the stage of fear and self-doubt. It's a hollow play, but they'll clap anyway. My body is a cage that keeps me from dancing with the one I love, but my mind holds a key. Standing next to me, my mind holds a key. I'm living in an
back. This is the Main Course Part Q on Heritage Radio Network. My name is Katie Kiefer. My host, my co-host Patrick Martins is on the road, but he'll be back next week. We're here in Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street. A beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And our host today, I mean, our sponsor today is Roberta's as well. So in the studio with me is food historian Andy Smith, author of 17 books and counting, and Curtis B. Wayne, the host of Burning Down the House.
Every Wednesday here at HeritageRadioNetwork.com at 8 p.m.
That's
Eastern
right.
Time.
And we were just hotly debating the urban myth of Washington Carver and the rise of
the
peanuts.
Popularization of peanuts for human consumption.
As opposed to livestock.
And Andy tells me that it's a lie and a damned lie.
Well, I said it a little stronger than that, but,
right.
but what can
and
I say?
Blows were exchanged, but luckily we were on break.
So, Andy, people ate peanuts before Washington Carver came and did his stuff?
Peanuts were consumed in the American South prior to the Civil War, and when the Union armies marched into the South after the war.
Goodness, how delicious, eating goober peas.
And so that is one of the songs that comes out of the Civil War. So it is Northerners that say, hey, this stuff is really good, and we'd like some ourselves. And so it's one of the first things that the South begins to export to the North, other than cotton, is peanuts.
Uh-huh.
And so peanuts become an important part of American diet in the late 19th century.
Yeah, but it became part of an American diet in a different sense than it is part of the diet in South
Correct.
Asian cooking and
yes.
in African
it starts
cooking.
Off as, right. It starts off as a snack food.
Yeah.
And it starts off as a product that is really sold on the streets. So street vendors sell it, et cetera. Then it happens to be the peanut butter is a vegetarian conspiracy. It's John Harvey Kellogg who's trying to create something that's an alternate to cow's butter. So
right.
he starts putting butters through steel rollers like he did corn and coming up with cornflakes, and he put peanuts through them, and he ends up with peanut butter. So he's the one that, in fact, invents it. And within a period of 10 years, virtually
Fabulous.
Every community in America has a peanut butter manufacturing company, not the way John Harvey Kellogg would have liked it, because they add sugar to it, and
right.
they add other
and
things
they hydrogenate.
More. And they do also, well, later on, hydrogenation
that's later,
comes
yeah,
in,
right.
but at the beginning, that's not the case. So the answer is, George Washington Carver comes along about two decades after this and takes a look at it and says there's a real problem boll weevil in the American South, and that is that the boll weevil has destroyed the cotton crops of most of the sharecroppers who happen to be African American. So he says there's good products that you can grow, and if you can't sell them, you can eat them. And one of them
right.
happens to be sweet potatoes. Another one happens to be peanuts.
Uh-huh.
And so he does popularize peanuts. So you're absolutely right.
So he repopularizes them as a sharecropper crop.
But
people were still
that,
people were eating peanuts anyway before that.
And he then gets good visibility. He goes, if not the first, he's one of the first African Americans to address Congress.
Sure, T.R. had him into the White House.
And so he has a whole series of different things that he's able to begin to promote. And then it happens that the peanut companies latch on to him and actually pay him a lot of money to do experimentation. He does a lot of experimentation with peanuts, none of which are commercialized, but all of which popularize
peanuts. Like what, turning it into biofuel or what?
Did he
make peanut oil?
Peanut oil would have been sold prior to that time, but he does make peanut oil, and peanut oil will become popular while he is alive. So it's not really until the 1930s that you have vegetable oils. Prior to the mm-hmm. time, lard would have been by far the number one.
Yeah,
oil.
Or Crisco.
Well, Crisco comes in about 1910, 1911, something
uh-huh.
like that. So, and that's becomes the Jewish alternative to lard.
To schmaltz.
To lard.
Of course, because you can't eat pork fat, right?
Right. So, and it's promoted that way with early advertisements are in Yiddish. And I mean,
I have no idea.
It's a fascinating, it's a
oh
great story.
Oh, my God, you're so cool, Andy. Jesus.
Grasp me another question. All right.
For
$10.
So sweet potatoes come in around that time with
Washington
Carver?
Well, sweet potatoes are there sweet potatoes come in much earlier, too, but they're in the South, and they're really not a part of Thanksgiving until the late 19th century, when the South needs to export products, and another one of the things that they begin to export.
Now, I have a question for you. Is when I know that sweet potatoes are actually those yellow-fleshed, that's the true sweet potato, and what we think of as a sweet potato, the orange-fleshed tuber, is a yam. And that's the African version. Where does the sweet potato?
That's a nice story too.
Oh!
You you got to get together. The problem comes in. The yam is.
We hosts do not compare notes beforehand. This is a live broadcast. What you get is what you hear.
That's right.
The yam is a totally different plant, having no relationship whatsoever to the sweet potato. It's an African plant.
That's right.
That also comes into America through the slave trade, and it is grown in America.
Oh, so you are referring to the true sweet potato,
yes,
which has the pale yellow flesh.
No, it has both. So the sweet potato's inside can be any color whatsoever.
I've never seen them anything but sort of yellow.
Go to the South America or go to Africa, you'll see them in all. They come in all different shapes and all different colors.
Cool.
But the yam never makes it as much in America. You can buy yams today, but historically, my grandfather, who was from the South, called sweet potatoes yams. And so if you would walk into a store and they had a yam sign up there, at least when I was young, they would have been actually a sweet potato. They would have had no connection.
Now, which one's the pointy?
You can be both. Both of them can
could be pointy.
Yeah.
But the fat and really dark orange one that gets very creamy
is a sweet
potato. The one that we that I thought that was the yam.
No, there are
and
yams.
Then the
so how do you tell the difference between them?
Well, there's one that says yam.
Well, no, but they seem to
they're
market
very
them
similar.
Ubiquitously
they're very similar,
as sweet potatoes.
But they're different plants.
They're different plants, absolutely different plants.
And at what point does this become part of the Thanksgiving feast?
In the late, Thanksgiving was a northern holiday. You've got to understand. It's
okay.
Abraham
it
Lincoln. And it wasn't celebrated in the South for many years.
And what about
after
when people started populating the Far West?
Oh no!
The whole Homestead Act and the
it was always part of the West. And I have a California Thanksgivings from 1850, which is very, very shortly after it became part of the United States. So you have the tradition there, and Thanksgiving was celebrated in parts of the South too. So, but it didn't become a state holiday. You can have a national holiday and not have a state holiday until the late 19th century. So it's only then that they forgave the North and forgave the Yankees for that. And again, the Thanksgiving holiday was certainly celebrated in the South before the Civil War. It's just the association of Sarah Josepha Hale and Abraham Lincoln and Gettysburg. And
yeah, but you change the subject. My question was, at one point, does the sweet potato become part of the...
As soon as the South begins to celebrate Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay. So in the 1890s.
Well, it would have been before that, but by the 1890s, it becomes a traditional requirement, and also in New England. So, and if you go to a restaurant, you would have been, and it was a surprise. I mean, it's a color, it's different than the potato.
Oh, sure.
Which, again, there's no relationship
none whatsoever.
At all.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have different colors and different flavors and different things you can do with it. But
we spoke earlier about how potatoes were part of the early American experience. When did that really start to pick up?
The first record that I could find was...
I want to know who to blame because much beloved Aunt Eleanor always made mashed potatoes, they were always tasting like a library paste.
Oh, I'd like potatoes. What can I say?
I love potatoes.
But in
potatoes,
any case,
I
want to answer your question.
To me, they're the perfect food.
Your question is, the earliest record that we can find, the primary record of what we think of as white potatoes today in the United States is not really until the early 18th century. And they're brought over into the United States through Protestants from Ireland. So Presbyterian Irish or
Scotch-Irish
come over and bring a potato with them to it. But a potato, of course, starts off in South America, goes into Europe, and then comes into the United States through the Europe.
So
because they were cultivated in Ireland, in the British Isles, because it was somehow the climate was worked well for them, and they didn't have any other cereal crops really there. Crops.
Ireland had lots of cereal crops,
besides oats,
and all of it was controlled by the English. And so the only thing that you could really grow in the rocky areas of which the Irish were essentially pushed was the white potato, and the white potato is with the skins and many Irish also had a cow, and if you add the milk and the cheese and other products with the white potato, you have a relatively nutritious food that large number of Irish were dependent on, and that's
absolutely.
Of course
cheap,
leads to the disaster that happens in the 1840s
with the potato famine
with the blight. Like the tomato blight that we had this last summer.
Same blight. Exactly
it's the same blight.
Yeah.
The tomatoes were decimated by a potato.
Wiped out my early pumpkin crop.
Well,
just totally went flat.
Well, the potatoes and tomatoes are very closely botanically connected, and you can actually plant a potato bottom, and you can graft on a tomato top, and you can have tomatoes and potatoes at the same plant. They're not very big, but you can do that.
Wow.
I knew that you wanted
what
that information.
What a fun experiment.
I could see that.
Wanted to
you
know that.
You can tell that we're going to do
that.
That
right now.
Is Brendan listening? I want to see that happen right upstairs here at Roberta's restaurant.
We need the dissection kit over in the propagation station.
But the blight is the same. And in fact, the potato blight was also a tomato blight. And it just, nobody was dependent on tomatoes.
On tomatoes.
And so they were on potatoes.
Well, tomatoes were considered poisonous for many, many years.
Oh,
when
good.
They first
I love this.
Came,
I love this.
No, come on. When they first came over to Europe, the Europeans would need tomatoes.
If you're on a macrobiotic diet,
because aren't they all part of the nightshade family? Isn't that the problem?
I thought that too when I started my work. And in the United States, the question was why weren't more tomatoes eaten at an earlier time? They really don't come in until they don't become popular until the 1820s, 1830s. And my question was why didn't they become popular before that? And all the answers were they thought the tomato was poisonous. And I looked for 15 years. I found exactly 7 references to poisonous tomatoes in America.
Really?
And virtually everyone was a joke, saying, can you believe that they believe this, as opposed to
But then why weren't they cultivated more widely in France, Spain, and
They are.
And Italy.
They're from Spain, from the earliest. I mean, the tomato is not uncovered by the Spanish don't run into the tomato until 1518. And within 20 years, you have the tomato alive and well in Spain, and you have the first recipe published in Italy. So you really do have that. Now,
by 1520?
By 1543 is the first recipe.
So I'm guessing that what really made the tomato take off in America was the invention of ketchup.
I was hoping you'd say that too, but that's unfortunately not true again. ketchup is a product most likely the British ran into it in what's today Indonesia. It's ketchup. You go to Indonesia, you can find ketchup there. It's soy sauce is what it is. And when they took the idea back to England, there is no soybeans there.
They added tomato to this.
Well, no, they started with liver. They started with walnuts. They started with mushrooms. They started with every product you can think of, they made a ketchup out of it. And it's the Americans that will, a couple hundred years later, will actually create
it. I have a really old recipe for ketchup that's from, you know, a friend of mine's like great-great-grandmother. So it was, I think, probably around 1840, 1850. Mm-hmm. And that...
Oh, by that time, it's actually, you have commercial...
It was pretty, ketchup, it was very popular already by then, because it was clearly a recipe that was a household...
It was upper class, and it cost about $4 a pint, which that's in 1840
money.
That's
a huge amount of money.
1840 money, not money today, so you're talking 30, 40, 50 bucks today.
Yeah.
And so it was really only consumed in restaurants with obviously... that people could afford to go to.
Right.
So it'd be very expensive.
Right. Well, we made ketchup when I was a child. My parents were always engaging in these bizarre sort of culinary experiments when I was little.
I tried too.
Yeah, it took, about a bushel of tomatoes to make about a quart of sauce. Yeah. Right? Didn't you find that to be the same thing? My parents were just astonished.
Well, and it never ended up the same color, the same consistency.
Oh, no, never.
But to circle back to the great American
big American feed
that is coming up.
Yes,
are there any traditional or formerly traditional Thanksgiving foods that have fallen out of favor that are worthy?
Yeah, I was just going to say, what
being
about corn?
Resurrected in the way that Patrick Martin says resurrected heritage.
Yeah, let's talk about
turkey.
Heritage. Like, why isn't there a Thanksgiving recipe that is based on a corn?
Well, cornbread would be common in the South.
Would have been, yeah.
Yeah, it still is.
It is. And cornbread stuffing.
And
even cornbread. I used to make that a lot.
And also, I think your answers to the stuffings are things that have changed dramatically. So today you've got the stuff that come to put the breadcrumbs and the whatnot, put the junk in.
Oh, those
in
weird
there.
Little bread cubes, coming about.
And all that's a 1920s invention. So prior to that time, you would have used a whole variety of things, like you mentioned the oysters. But there are 1,000 different things you can put into turkeys. And historically, people would have put almost anything into it. Anything that they had, they would have put into it. And then you pull it out, and that's the side dishes. So it isn't the stuffing that we think of. It could be beans. It could be virtually anything that you can put in there.
No kidding.
No. Wow.
I would never have thought to cook something like a green bean inside my bird.
Why not?
I don't know.
How about baked beans?
You can put anything in it. Well, baked beans are much easier to cook elsewhere, but you can put beans inside. You can put anything inside a turkey, and historically people have.
And it would be basted with the turkeys
with
and
the
juices.
But boy, sure. You better hope there's a lot of liquid in there, because, I mean, well, you would have soaked your beans before you put them in, for sure.
Yeah.
That could be good. Ooh, I'd be willing to try that.
You have to let us know how that worked out.
Yeah. I think it'd be really delicious with some bacon or pancetta.
Oh, yeah. Lima beans and pancetta.
Well, that's another thing. You have the butterball turkey today, but historically, turkeys would have been larded. So under the skin, you would have put lard, or you put all sorts of other things. To the problem with the turkey is you're cooking a long time, and it dries out.
Yeah.
And so one of the ways of getting around that is by larding a turkey, by putting fat or bacon or ham or lots of other things under
sure.
it. And it really does add a different flavor and a different taste to the
yeah.
turkey.
Yeah, well, the turkey is endlessly adaptable to flavor
needs,
differences.
Some resurrection, perhaps.
Right. And then there is a turkey tradition that has been slightly resurrected, but it really goes back to the Renaissance, and that's when you have a turducken with a turkey.
I knew you were going to say that.
Turkey inside,
a duck.
Quail, and historically,
you can do many,
birds
the,
inside other birds.
Birds inside of birds.
Well, gut
cavities. With stuffing around the outside, inside each one. But
so
that's a Renaissance. That's a Renaissance recipe. Yeah. And historically, you would have deboned all of the birds first before you put them in.
So, in other words, Paul Prudhomme cannot take credit for the turducken.
What he says, if
he can take credit for the name.
K-Paul?
No, K-Paul. Yeah. When you read what he says, I was looking at a cookbook and I found this recipe and I thought it was a really good idea. And so what he does is he takes a recipe that traditionally goes back 500 years and he creates something very new out of it. And I like that. So taking the past in order to
inform the present.
Keep the present and keep it alive. And I think that's great.
Well, that's something that artists do.
Right.
A lot. They'll take a reference from a painting from hundreds of years ago or 50 years ago and incorporate it into a painting now. Well, right. I mean, some artists.
Now, here's a tradition I hope does not survive, will not be reenacted, and that is, historically, you would have baked a turkey, then you would have taken it out of the oven, you would then put the feathers back on the turkey, then you would bring the turkey out to demonstrate how this big bird looked with its feathers on. Because the turkey looks ugly without the feathers. Feathers is what gives the turkey beauty.
It's crispy golden skin.
And you would sew them in. It's not just
poke them.
Sewed them in?
Absolutely.
They didn't put them in an aspic?
No, they put them in. They sewed them in. And then they would take everybody around, everybody go ooh and aw. I mean, you got to have the turkey with its fan tail out on the outside. How do you know it's a turkey if you don't have that? It's ugly otherwise. So then you take it back into the kitchen. You would pull out the stitches and pull out the feathers.
Pull off the
feather
coat.
And then you would carve it. Then you take it outside again, and then there would be an official carver. And in my family, the tradition was the eldest male was the carver. I don't know if that continues today.
That was definitely the tradition in my family.
14th century. You have the whole notion of a carver, and it's a royalty. That's not the hoi polloi. It is the person who's next in line to whoever the top person is. So if the king is there, it's the king's.
Then the king's person
whoever
does it. Yeah.
But it's a top royal
Prince
function.
Charles carves then.
And then you carve, and then obviously the person who sits at the front first part of the table gets the best piece, whatever that may be, and then it goes all around the end of it. Then you end up at the bottom with the whatever is left over. So those are traditions that I hope will not be reenacted.
Well, I think that everybody needs to read up on their food history. Last year, I read a book called The Illustrated History of Food, which was a wonderful compilation of essays and chapters on different parts of the world and how food came into various stages of its popularity and styles. And I guess we have to wrap it up now. I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving, Andy Smith. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us the story of Thanksgiving.
I'm honored to be here. This is wonderful.
And Curtis, thank you very much for
thank
being
for,
such a wonderful guest interlocutor.
Over.
Thank you to Nat Wiener, our engineer, Jack Inslee, the producer today. Roberta's Restaurant was our sponsor. This is the main course.
Hey, Roberta's.
Next week, Patrick will be back. And we'll be talking to him about the turkey business and much, much more. So long for now.